This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're ending 2005 by featuring some of our favorite interviews of the year. I spoke with Gene Wilder last March after the publication of his memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger. The title was suggested by his wife, Gilda Radner, 3 weeks before she died of ovarian cancer in 1989. Gene Wilder made his movie debut in Bonnie and Clyde. He starred in Mel Brooks' 1968 film The Producers, which was adapted into the hit Broadway show and has now been adapted back into a movie. In Mel Brooks' film Young Frankenstein, Wilder played Dr. Frankenstein. He starred with Richard Pryor in Silver Streak and Stir Crazy and portrayed the candy maker in the 1971 film Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, which was remade this year. Let's start with one of Gene Wilder's classic scenes from The Producers. Zero Mostel plays an over-the-hill producer. Wilder is his new and timid accountant, Leo Bloom. While going through the books, Bloom realizes that with some creative accounting, it would be possible to make more money with a flop than a hit.
Let's assume, just for the moment, that you are a dishonest man.
Assume away.
It's very easy. You simply raise more money than you really need.
What do you mean?
Well, you did it yourself, only you did it on a very small scale.
What'd I do?
You raised $2,000 more than you needed to produce your last play.
So what? What did it get me? I'm wearing a cardboard belt.
Well, that's where you made your mistake. You didn't go all the way. You see, if you were really a bold criminal, you could have raised $1 million.
But the play cost me only $60,000 to produce.
And how long did it run?
One night.
You see? Do you see what I'm trying to tell you? You could have raised $1 million, put on a $60,000 flop, and kept the rest.
But what if the play was a hit?
Well, then you'd go to jail. Oh. See, once the play's a hit, you have to pay off all the backers. And with so many backers, there could never be enough profits to go around. Get it?
So in order for this scheme to work, we'd have to find a surefire flop.
What scheme?
Gene Wilder told me that when he met Mel Brooks, Wilder was in a production of Mother Courage that also featured Anne Bancroft. Her boyfriend was Mel Brooks.
I met Mel backstage in Anne's dressing room. He was wearing one of those pea coats, pea jackets that were made famous by the Merchant Marines, and I admired it, and he said, you know, they used to call this a urine jacket, but it didn't sell. and I laughed, and he laughed. And after we saw each other several times, he said, would you like to come to Fire Island and spend the weekend with Anne and me? I'd like to read the first 30 pages of this movie I'm writing called Springtime for Hitler. And I said, I'd like that very much. And then I went there one June weekend, and he read me the first 30 pages of what was later called The Producers.
Now, he offered you the part before he had finished reading it, writing it. But
yeah.
On the other hand, after offering you the part, you had to audition for Zero Mostel, because Zero Mostel was a big star, and he
That's
had to be
right.
comfortable with the people in the cast, and he had to be convinced that you were the right guy. So what did you have to do for him?
Well, Mel said, you know, I love you, but Zero doesn't know you, and he has the right of approval of whoever's going to play Leo Bloom. So come to the office, and you'll do a reading with him. So I went to the office on a Thursday or Friday morning and knocked on the door, and Mel opened it. And I saw Zero Mostel in the background, and he said, come on in, come on in. Gene, this is Z. Z, this is Gene. And I put out my hand to shake hands with him, and he took my hand and he pulled me up to his face and he gave me a kiss on the lips. And all my nervousness went out the window. And I think he must have done it on purpose, because he understood actors and how I would naturally be a little nervous doing this. And I gave a very good reading, and then I got the part.
What was it like playing opposite Zero Mostel, who is big in every way? He has big features. He was a big man. His gestures were big. His voice was loud. And your character was supposed to be very meek and insecure.
Well, you say the character was meek and insecure. You could have been describing me as well. I was a very shy person in those days. And working with Zero, who was bigger than life, helped me grow. Zero was a strong influence on me. We didn't go out to lunch. We always stayed in the studio, High Brown Studios, and I think it was 27th Street in Manhattan. And we'd have lunch together, a sandwich and a cup of soup. And he would talk to me about the days of the blacklisting and everything he went through. And they ruined his life for a while. And then when he came back in... I think funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, and then all of his other big successes on Broadway. He wasn't afraid of authority in any form, and that's the part that influenced me the most. He would tell anyone anything, not to be impolite, but he'd show that he wasn't at all afraid of however much money that person or whatever title they had in a company. It didn't scare him. And Mel was very much the same way.
My guest is Gene Wilder. Here's a scene from Young Frankenstein in which Wilder played the grandson of the infamous mad scientist. He's at the train station in Transylvania meeting his new assistant, played by Marty Feldman.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
You're putting me on.
No, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Do you also say Frederick?
No. Frederick.
Well, why isn't it Frederick Frankenstein?
It isn't. It's Frederick Frankenstein.
I see.
You must be Igor.
No, it's pronounced Igor.
But they told me it was Igor.
Well, they were wrong then, weren't they?
Gene Wilder, you came up with the premise for Young Frankenstein. You officially share credits with Mel Brooks, shares credit with you for the screenplay and the screen story. What gave you the idea of writing Young Frankenstein? Did you love the Frankenstein movie?
Well, I think it was my fear of the Frankenstein movies when I was 8 and 9 and 10 years old that made me want to write that story, that I was a young doctor or dental hygienist and found out that my great-grandfather, Beaufort von Frankenstein, left me the whole estate. That was all I had in mind at the time. And then my agent at the time, Mike Medavoy, before he became a movie mogul, called me up and said, how about a movie with you and Peter Boyle and Marty Feldman? And I said, well, what makes you think of that? He said, because I now handle you and Peter and Marty. And I said, well, as it happens, I do have something. Well, send it to me right now. I said, no, I want to work on it a little bit. And that night I wrote 2 more pages. The Transylvania Station scene, almost verbatim the way it is in the film. And then I sent it off to him. And he said, I think I can sell this. And maybe we can get Mel to direct. And I said... I don't think he's going to direct something he didn't conceive of. And Mel, you have to understand this important point. He had done The Producers for $50,000 over 2 years, and he didn't make a penny from it. And then he did The 12 Chairs, $50,000 for 2 more years, and didn't make a penny from it. That's 4 years of work. And then they offered him quite a bit of money to direct Young Frankenstein. And he took it. He called me first. He said, what are you getting me into? I said, nothing you don't want to get into. He said, I don't know. The next day, I got a call saying Mel's going to do it.
There's quite a few really classic jokes in Young Frankenstein. One of them, and this seems like it's probably the oldest joke in the world, and I'm not sure.
Oh, dear.
I think you know the walk this way joke.
Now,
why don't you describe how it happens in the movie, and tell me if it's something that you and Brooks came up with, or whether this joke has a long previous life, because it seems like, I don't know I ever heard it before the movie, but it seems like it should have been around forever. Do you know what I mean?
I had never heard of it before, and while we were filming outdoors on location, mm-hmm. Mel says to Marty Feldman, Marty...
Who's playing the doctor's assistant.
Yeah, Igor.
Your assistant, yeah.
Or Igor. He says, bend over and say to Gene, walk this way, and then crouch down and walk away. And I said, Mel, what does that mean? He said, I'll tell you later. Just do it for now. And so I took the cane, and I followed Marty after the camera started rolling. And I walked this funny walk, and everyone laughed afterwards. And I said, "Now will you tell me what it means?" He says, "A man has a terrible case of hemorrhoids. He goes into a drugstore, and he says, have you got some talcum powder for me? I've got terrible hemorrhoids." And the pharmacist says, "Walk this way." And he says, "If I could walk that way, I wouldn't need the talcum powder." And I said, "Where did that come from?" He says, "It's an old vaudeville routine. It's years old." But I had never heard of it before. But it worked.
And oh, another real classic one. When you get to the castle,
No, don't.
What? There's these large brass door knockers
with knobs. Yeah.
With knobs on them. And yeah. as you're approaching the door, you lift
Terry Garr.
Yeah, that's right. You lift Terry Garr out of the wagon that you've arrived in, and your head is kind of buried in her chest.
Well, he knocks on the door, and just when Terry's breast is brushed up against my face, I look and see the knockers, and I say, "What knockers?" And she says, "Thank you, doctor."
Now, how'd you guys come up with that one? It also this is a classic.
No,
yeah.
that's Mel. That's mm-hmm. Mel. That wasn't written. He just said, when you lift her off the wagon like that, look at the knockers and say, "What knockers?" Well, I thought it was very funny at the time. But that wasn't written. That was just improvised. It wasn't improvised. He just said, "Say what knockers," and it worked.
My guest is Gene Wilder. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Gene Wilder. Here's a scene from Silver Streak, one of the films he starred in with Richard Pryor. They're on the lam, and Wilder is trying to disguise himself as a black man.
"I can't pass for black."
"You tell him. I didn't say I was going to make you black. I said I was going to get you on the train. Now we got to make them cops think you're black."
"It'll never work.
Never.
What, are you afraid it won't come off?"
"Oh, that's a good joke. That's humorous.
Like that.
May I speak?"
"Yeah. This is crazy! It'll never work, don't you understand?" "Are you kidding? Look at that. Al Joseph made $1 million looking like that. That's bad, man. You're looking good. Now, here, take this radio. When you step out of here, you gotta step out of here like King shit, right? You bad. And just move with the rhythm of the music. Let me see you try. Step to the music. Yeah. Stop.
How come you whiteys got such a tight ass, man? How you gonna walk out of here with a tan face and that white walk?
Just get into the music. Come on, George. Come on. Yeah, now try it. Don't you feel it? Yeah. Needs work, George. Needs a lot of work. You know that."
Let me ask you about working with Richard Pryor. You made several films with him, including Silver Streak and Stir Crazy. How were you first paired?
I was in Paris doing publicity for some film, and I got a call from Alan Ladd Jr., who was then the head of 20th Century Fox, and he said, "I have a script here, and I have to decide. I want you to play the part, but you have to tell me that you want to." So he sent me the script. I read it, and I called him. I said, "I want to do this." But I said, "You're going to be in a lot of trouble if you don't get the right person to play the Richard Pryor part." And I said, "The only one I can think of is Richard Pryor." And he said, "That's who we're thinking of." And then they offered it to Richard, and he took it, and I met him for the first time in Calgary, in Canada. A very quiet, modest meeting. We gave each other a hug. He said how much he admired me. I said how much I admired him. And we started working the next morning. And we hit it off really well. And he taught me how to improvise on camera. I had improvised a lot in classes and at the actor's studio, but I never did it in front of the camera. And I said a line in our first scene together, and then he said something that wasn't in the script, and I responded without thinking. And then he responded to that, and then we went back to the script.
There's a scene from Silver Streak that you describe in the book where Richard Pryor wanted the scene changed. And I want you to describe the scene and how he changed it.
Well, we'd finished filming at the train station in Toronto, and Arthur Hiller said, let's run through that bathroom scene where you put on the shoe polish, just lightly, just the words, so we have a sense of where we're going. It was the one scene that I was the most worried about, and I thought, well, if Richard doesn't mind my putting on the shoe polish in order to pass as black, then it must be okay, because he's the teacher here. And we went in there, and we read the scene, and Richard became more and more morose. And when we walked out, and we were going to film this the next morning early, and we walked out across the street to the Royal York Hotel, and I said, Richard, what's the matter? He said, I'm going to hurt a lot of black people doing this scene. I said, didn't you read it before? He said, well, yeah, but sometimes I have people read it to me, and I thought it was okay at the time, but I'm going to hurt a lot of black people. I said, why? Tell me what's wrong with it. No, it's too late, too late. I said, tell me what's wrong, Richard. I can call Alan Ladd Jr. I can call Arthur Hiller, our director. Tell me. He said, it's too late, Gene. It's just too late. I said, I'm in room, whatever it was. If you change your mind, would you call me? 15 minutes later, he said, can I come down and see you? I said, of course. He came down. I said, are you going to tell me what's wrong? He said, yeah. You're in there in the bathroom, in the men's room, and you're putting shoe polish on your face, and a white man comes in, and he doesn't think that it's anything unusual, because that's how niggers behave, right? I said, well, what should it be? He said, it should be a black man who comes in, who sees what you're doing, knows right away that you're white and doing this because you must be in some kind of trouble. And he says, I don't know what your trouble is, mister, but you got to keep time with the music. You got to keep time. And I said, well, that's a better scene. So we called Arthur Hiller that night. Arthur Hiller recast the part, and the next morning we did the scene as Richard described it.
My guest is Gene Wilder, and he's written a memoir called Kiss Me Like a Stranger, My Search for Love and Art. Let's go back to your very early days. You wrote about your mother. She had her first heart attack when you were 8, and you say her heart specialist told you, don't ever argue with your mother, you might kill her. Try to make her laugh. How did that affect you, hearing that?
You know, I can imagine what it did. This was a big man, a heavyset, fat heart specialist who was sweating like a pig after he helped bring my mother home from the hospital. And he took me by the arm, and the sweat was dripping down his face onto my cheek. And he said, don't ever get angry with your mother, because you might kill her. What effect that had on me, I can speculate, but that's too long a story. It was enormous. It had an enormous effect on me. But the second thing, try to make her laugh. That was the first time, and I did try, it was the first time I ever tried consciously to make someone else laugh. And when I was successful, after peeing in her pants, she'd say, oh, Jerry, now look what you've made me do. And she'd run off to the bathroom. And you know, when your mother gives you confidence about anything that you do, you carry that confidence with you. And she made me believe that I could make someone laugh. In those days, I was thinking more in terms of being a comedian, I think. But when I saw at 16, I started studying acting at 13, but when I saw Death of a Salesman at 16, it changed my whole conception of acting, performing. I didn't want to be a comedian. I wanted to be an actor, maybe a comic actor, but a real actor. By real, I mean not a comedian. I wanted to be an actor.
Gene Wilder recorded last March after the publication of his memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger. We'll continue the interview in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Here's Gene Wilder singing on the soundtrack of Willy Wonka.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me, and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look, and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it, want to change the world, there's nothing to it.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Let's get back to the interview I recorded last March with actor Gene Wilder just after the publication of his memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger. In your memoir, you write toward the end about your marriage to Gilda Radner and what it was like to watch her get really sick and then die. How did you meet her?
I met her on the first night of filming... of night filming on a film called Hanky Panky that Sidney Poitier was directing. And it's funny, I was in costume and makeup, right, tuxedo and makeup, because I had done a few shots before she arrived. And she told me later that she cried all the way in the car, because she knew that she was going to fall in love with me and want to get married. I said, "Now, Gilda, now this is an exaggeration." She said, no, it's true. I was unhappy. I was married. I was unhappy. And I knew I was going to fall in love with you." I asked her that maybe a year or two later. I would always question. She said, "Yes, it's true. I did feel that way." That's how we met, on doing the film. And then... She couldn't be alone. She wanted to be, attach herself, graft herself onto me. And I thought, this is never going to work. I loved her. That's the truth. But I didn't think I would ever be able to live with her, because she couldn't do anything without me, it seemed. And then... one day, I was going to go with her to France for my birthday, and I was really tired after finishing a film. And my sister, Corinne, had been diagnosed with breast cancer, and I wanted to go in and see her in New York. And the dog, Gilda's dog, Sparkle, was sniffing around in the airport and ate some... I thought didn't eat. Gilda thought she did eat rat poison. And she rushed her to a vet, and she told me, "You go on ahead, honey. You're tired. I know you love me, and you know I love you, and I'll be fine. You just relax and enjoy yourself." And I thought, I waited for a year and a half for words like that from her. "I'll be all right. I'm fine. I know you love me, you know I love you." And I came back from France and proposed to her. And then a short while later, she was diagnosed, unfortunately, 10 months too late, she was diagnosed with stage 4 ovarian cancer. My odyssey with Gilda was wonderful, funny, tortuous, painful, and sad. It went the full gamut.
I thought it was interesting that 6 weeks before she died, she started taking singing lessons.
Yeah. And what she worked on was When You Wish Upon a Star. I'd hear her practicing that, and when the piano teacher, the singing teacher, came over, he'd play that, and she would sing it, and he would work on her voice singing it. And she had a wonderful voice. I think she was doing it just because she wanted to have someone play while she sang. But that was the song that she picked. Still Magical Thinking. If I wish upon a star, maybe the cancer will go away.
She was 43 when she died in 1989. And, I mean, you lost your wife. Her death was so publicly mourned. She had so many fans in the country. And I was just wondering, how did that complicate your own recovery from that? Because, you know, when someone is famous, their death becomes something of a public event, no matter how private the funeral itself is, because the grief is felt by so many people. And it's written up in newspapers and magazines and so on. Mm-hmm. So how did that affect your ability to do what you emotionally needed to do during that period?
After she died, you mean?
Yeah.
There wasn't a funeral per se. I buried her 3 miles from the house that she had bought just shortly before we met. It was an old house, old colonial house, 1734, and there were just a few friends at the funeral, a non-sectarian cemetery, and an old friend of hers from junior high school or high school was the rabbi in town, and the town that we lived in, and he performed the service. And I came home and I thought, if I go back to California, where I had a small house, I don't think I'll ever come east again. So I decided to stay and go through the halls and stairways, talk to her, holler, express some of my anger, and make sure there were no ghosts in the hallways that I should ever be afraid of. And then I found out, it sounds strange, but I found out she had left me the house. We never talked about her dying and what she was going to leave me or I would ever leave her. We just didn't talk about those things. And then her business manager said, you know, Gilda left you that house. And that's when I decided to stay and test it out. And after about a month, the roots grew, and I didn't ever want to live anywhere else for the rest of my life. Travel, yes, but not to live anywhere else.
Gene Wilder, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Gene Wilder recorded last month, after the publication of his memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger.